Number 19, the annual Wolf Management Plan Report, and Dr. Dinney. All things cuddly and cute.
Good morning, Mr. Chair, members of the commission, Director.
My name is Donnie Martorell. I'm the Wolf Policy Lead for Washington Fish and Wildlife, and today I'm here to present to you our annual report on our Wolf Conservation Management Plan. Some of the things I'll be overviewing today will be just a reminder of our recovery objectives from our plan, an update on the population trends that we've seen in this last year, an update on some of the conflict and interactions that we've seen in the last year, and preparation. Quick summary on stakeholder engagement, research, and budget. So this will be a review, I think, for almost everybody, but it's good context here. Of course, the department completed the Wolf Conservation Management Plan in 2011, and that's our operating path. There are four objectives in that plan: to restore self-sustaining wolf populations, to manage wolf-livestock conflict to try to reduce and minimize that, to maintain healthy prey base and for wolves, and also at the same time continuing to provide recreational opportunity for hunters for ungulates, and the last one, to develop a public understanding of wolf management and coexistence. A couple quick definitions of things we'll be talking about in the presentation. When we talk about a pack, that's two or more animals traveling together. And then the metric that Sean already mentioned, a successful breeding pair, that's for a male and female adult wolves that produce pups in April. If at least two of those pups survive until the end of December, they qualify as a successful breeding pair. Also, a quick review, our recovery objectives in our plan. Initiate the delisting process when we reach 15 successful breeding pair for three consecutive years. And those 15 successful breeding pair are distributed amongst the three recovery areas, and we'll be talking about those quite a bit. So four, four, and four, and then the remaining floaters that can be in any of the recovery areas. Or 18 successful breeding pair in a single year. And we'll get to one of Sean's points as well. A little off script here, but one of the analysis that we worked on here a few years ago and published was based on the recovery of wolves in neighboring states, the Northern Rocky Mountain ecosystem, and in the demographics from those states that we projected that we might see us reaching recovery objectives in 2021. It's not a prediction or a goal or anything like that. It's just based on the information we have available at hand, and I'll talk a little bit more about that, where we are in terms of that path. Also, real quickly, in terms of the listing status, wolves are state-listed as endangered throughout the state. On the federal side, under federal ESA, they are delisted in the eastern part of the state. In that portion, they were part of the Rocky Mountain DPS, and they are federally listed under ESA as endangered in the western two-thirds. In terms of exchange of information about wolves between the department and the public and stakeholders, it goes both ways, of course. We hear from the public in a variety of ways. We have a 1-800 number for folks that have wolf-livestock conflict. Those folks also connect directly with our conflict specialists and our regional offices and our enforcement staff. We also try to get information out there in all the publications that we have on our internet and those sorts of things, so that we have two-way communication with communities. Kind of now roll into the population update. Before I start that, just a reminder on the capturing and monitoring of wolves. That's a year-round process for us. As I'll talk about in a moment, in the springtime, we are out catching wolves to radio collar them with leg hole traps. We monitor wolf populations throughout the year to understand pack demographics, the composition of packs, the number of animals in packs, breeding status, pup production, all those kinds of things. And of course, in the wintertime, as we prepare for this annual survey, we're out doing captures with helicopters and doing surveys either in fixed-wing aircraft or snowshoeing or those kinds of things. So it's a year-round process for us to monitor wolf populations. And folks are already familiar with this, that in the wintertime, when there's snow on the ground, that's our opportunity to get over wolves with a helicopter and put more radio collars out. Of course, we do that in packs that already have an active radio because we can home in on that animal, find other pack members, and the snow allows us to get over the top of them because it slows them down a little bit and deploy more collars. And then through spring, right around denning period, on through mid to late summer, we're using leg hold traps, padded leg hold traps, to go out and supplement those collars, but also for new packs that don't have any collars, that's our opportunity to try to get that first collar out. So in terms of where we're at in this last year, as of December 31st, 2016, we have 20 known packs, and I want to emphasize that's just the ones we know about. We know from our experience and also from other jurisdictions that we're not detecting all the packs. This is the increase that we've seen this last year is right on mark with what we've seen in past years. We saw a 28% increase from last year when we had 18 confirmed packs. And you'll see later on in the presentation that when I say that's right on mark, we generally see about a 30% increase in wolf populations each year. In terms of the new packs for this year, one of them was the Sherman pack, which we actually announced late spring to the public. And then the one that we just here recently documented is it's called the Tushy pack in the Blue Mountains. And then also I want to touch on, Sean brought up a good question. A lot of folks ask about this, and that is the distribution of these wolf packs and what that pattern looks like, and are we seeing any indication of things slowing down or barriers or those kinds of things. So if you were to zoom this lens out, we would see to the east a much larger wolf population that we're a part of. So northern Idaho, northwest Montana, and, of course, Wyoming, et cetera, a much, much larger population. From the wolf population standpoint, we're just an extension of that. So what we're seeing is the wolf population is naturally recolonizing from east to west. This is what we expected. And, in fact, in the modeling that we did a few years ago and published, that's exactly how the model operated as well, that recovery is going to occur from east to west. So roughly, we're about halfway, but we expect the next, if we're at a halfway mark, the next phase to actually go quicker than the first phase because the population is becoming larger, more robust, more reproduction, more dispersal, et cetera. So we have, as I'll show in just a moment, in terms of our breeding pairs, we have 8 in this area and 2 in this area. Again, the regional recovery objective is 4 for each recovery area and 3 floaters. So we're about halfway through this process. At this point, because we're seeing a steady around 30% increase per year, we're not expecting that I-90 is going to slow them down at all. We're at that anxious moment where we're waiting for the first pack to be in the coastal recovery area, and I think that we'll see that within the next couple of years.
Are there Cascade wolves in Oregon?
Yes, there are.
Because some of it is actually north movement, certainly down in the Blues. So is that a possibility for Washington then?
It is. Wolves are tremendous colonizers. Their mobility, they can go several hundred miles in a very short period of time, and I'll show that in a moment. So, yes, there are wolves. There are confirmed wolf activity packs in the Cascades of Oregon. There's also, if we were to expand this lens, just like in Northeast Washington and Northeast Oregon, there's also a number of packs here, and then, of course, in B.C. and to our neighbors in Idaho. So we have wolves dispersing from 3 sides.
Thank you.
And in that situation, when you might detect a pack that's quite a ways, it's a couple dispersers that meet up, have traveled several hundred miles and meet up, and that occurs fairly regularly. And I think that's what we're going to see eventually. So in terms of our effort this last year, and so as I go through this presentation, we're really speaking about the 2016 calendar year, unless I If it's not, I'll make sure to let you know. So during the year, we captured 15 wolves, 14 unique animals. You can see the breakdown there of mostly adults and yearlings. We radio collared 14 wolves through the course of the year using a helicopter or leg hold traps. During the entire course of the year, we were monitoring 20 different unique radio collared wolves. That's 22% of the minimum known population from 13 packs, or 65% of the minimum or the known packs. One item I'd like to call out here is that the amount of effort and cost to monitor wolves through this process, it's a lot of effort and a high cost. And it's one we've learned from our neighbors, the other states that have been doing this for a couple decades or decade and a half before us, is you fall farther and farther behind because the wolf population growth is exceeding our ability to keep up with the expansion. At the end of the 2016, we were monitoring 18 collared wolves.
You said radio collared? I thought they were GPS.
We have two kinds of radio collars, the conventional radio collar that just emits a signal, and GPS collars, and we use both of those.
Okay. Because the regular kind is really intensive. We need humans out sort of looking for those wolves.
That's the way I used to do it, before GPS collars showed up. Yes. In terms of the numbers, this is the statewide roll-up. So the minimum count increased by 28% from 90 to 115. Successful breeding pair increased from 8 to 10. We've documented 14 mortalities over the course of the year. I'll talk about that more in a minute. These are just dispersals of known animals, so radio-collared animals. Again, we've collared only a fraction, 22% of the minimum known population, and so there are many other dispersing animals out there that of course, we're not aware of. And we documented 15 confirmed depredations on livestock in 2016, and I'll talk more about each of those. I'm not going to go, obviously, through this.
Back up, if you would, Don. And there again, this is for my fellow commissioners to understand. They've got 15 confirmed depredations, but there were more cattle than that missing, correct?
Correct. Yes, this is 15 that we investigated and resulted in confirmed, and there were more that were probables. There were 6 probables as well. Plus, I think Commissioner Holzmiller speaking to is livestock that was never found that is beyond what the producers usually lose.
Yeah, and that needs to be reiterated because it was no different in Dave and Julie DeShiel's sheep that, you know, there again, and I understand the rules that you're working under, but in the real world, it's generally considerably more.
And I'll touch on that when we talk about depredations more and share some of those estimates. So obviously I'm not going to go through the full table here, but this is in the annual report. So our annual report is now online, and we did a news release yesterday to the public. Just going to hit the highlights here. There were, as I said, 8 successful breeding pair in the eastern Washington recovery area, which we see here on the slide. Carpenter Ridge, Dirty Shirt, Goodman Meadows, and Seton, Strawberry, and Sherman's, Skookum, and Smackout packs. You can see pack size is average about 5.5 or so. That's pretty typical. You notice here we have some packs, and then this is normal. There's variability in pack size. We have a pack here that's on the larger side. You can imagine that this spring with pups, the size of that pack. And it's that social tension of a pack that really causes that behavioral dispersal of kicking animals out. All of the documented known mortalities were in the eastern recovery area, a couple dispersals, and all the 15 depredations were in the eastern recovery area. Just real quickly touch on the mortalities. These are the 7 from Profanity Peak agency removal. Had a couple lawful harvest on the Spokane Indian Reservation, and then the normal mix of other losses for other causes, such as vehicle-wolf collisions. We had a research loss. Here's what that same information looks like in the North Cascades recovery area. Two of the packs met the definition of successful breeding pair. Minimum count was 18, and the others are zero, with the exception of one dispersing animal. So if we look at that trend, you've seen this graph before, and it'll look very similar in the years coming. This is the pattern that we've seen in a colonizing wolf population. It was very similar for the Northern Rocky Mountains ecosystem, about a 30% increase per year. Again, minimum number of known wolves. Here's the trend in the successful breeding pair. As Sean mentioned, encouraging. We are seeing that increase as well. That's the metric that we're using for our recovery objective, so it's good to see that increase. Trend in number of packs, very similar images, up to 20 known packs now. And then if we take that same trend in number of known packs, and you can see the pattern in number of known wolf mortalities.
Yeah, just you see kind of the trend. It looks like there's a linear increase. I imagine if you plotted it, you'd have a linear relationship over time. Were the models, and this is kind of, I wasn't around in the commission, but is eventually kind of the projection that you'd see an exponential growth, or are we gonna, is the assumption that you'd continue on a linear kind of increase?
Linear until it asymptotes out eventually. It's an artifact, or what's generating that is available prey and suitable vacant habitat. We're going to see that linear 30% per year until we reach saturation, and then asymptote out.
Okay, thanks.
Just a quick glimpse. It's always interesting to see images like this. You've seen them before. Just for 2016, here's the three dispersing animals that were wearing GPS collars. It is a visual that just shows how far these animals can go in a very short period of time. We've seen this similar kind of image from the Northern Rocky Mountains ecosystem that just shows dozens and dozens of wolves over a period of years dispersing. That's innate to them, and again, it's that social tension within the packs that creates that and initiates that dispersal. Going to switch gears now and talk about wolf-livestock conflict, both from a preventative sense and then some of agency actions. So in terms of managing wolf-livestock conflict, of course, the goal is to try to reduce as much as possible the negative interaction of wolves and livestock. And as you know, we have a number of wildlife conflict specialists that are strategically deployed around the state so that they can be in those communities and be that point person working with livestock producers around the state. We invest quite a bit, as you'll see, and trying to prevent conflict before it ever starts. We've also learned from other states that is one of the best things you can do for success or the desired outcome. Once conflicts start, it's very difficult to stop. So in terms of those wildlife conflict specialists, they do a number of things on the landscape with livestock producers. The core of that is the relationship, so it's that one-on-one time. I was recently talking with a team of our conflict specialists about sometimes you can develop that relationship with about 30 hours investment. Sometimes it takes 5 years. So the relationship is very critical and very important. And then I'll talk a little bit about some of the tools that we put on the landscape, a little bit about compensation, and, of course, lethal removal. I'm not going to go through all this, but just wanted to make the point that as we enter into the grazing season, which is typically kind of spring, June 1st, there's a number of things that we do to try to be prepared in our readiness for that, both in terms of communicating with livestock producers, having tools available, having resources available, and some of those I'll share more about. So the first one of those I'm calling kind of an informal, and that is our checklist of deterrent measures. This is something that our conflict specialists do where they have that relationship, they're meeting with producers, and they're talking about with them what works best for their operation. And it varies depending on the type of livestock, where it's at, how many animals, et cetera. And it's informal in the sense of it's not a signed contract. It's just working with them collaboratively, putting their heads together to come up with what the right strategies are that are best for their situation. And we call that our checklist. The next one is increased human presence. We have contracts with range riders in the state, over a dozen of those, and there are others that are contracted through NGOs or livestock producers employ their own. It's essentially a cowboy that has an added level of human presence on the landscape, beyond just checking on cows, but just a regular human presence on the landscape to monitor livestock, look for sick and injured, monitor livestock behavior, do all those things, detect early depredations, etc., to try to prevent conflict, and if it starts, to recognize it early and initiate other things. So that's the kind of the second bend, if you will. And then the next one is cost-share agreements that we have with producers. This is similar to the informal, the checklist, but in a formal way where they sign a contract and we help them through actual dollars and a cost-share agreement to help put items on the landscape. It could be fencing, it could be a range rider, it could be a guard dog, again, whatever is best for that operation. Oh, let's go back up. Hang on, I can do this. That is a little help from the audience. Oh, Great Pyrenees. So Sean mentioned the uptake of those proactive deterrence measures, and I've pulled out two here to just show kind of what we're seeing here. So this is the cost share agreements, the signed contracts, and the contracted range riders just deployed through Fish and Wildlife. And as you can see here, it's a very positive graph. We're seeing strong uptake of those deterrence measures. That's a great thing. As Sean mentioned, from 2015 to 2016, we saw about an 86% increase in the uptake of just these tools, and receptivity is there. We're projecting another 66% increase just in the conversations we've had with new producers on the landscape, and so this is a very encouraging pattern to see. If I now add the informal contacts now that are not signed agreements or contracted range riders, just add that to the bar graphs here, you can see the same pattern. And across the board, we're just seeing an increased receptivity of folks doing things on the landscape to try to prevent conflict before it begins. And one thing we did here, an interesting comparison, the blue line is the wolf population growth up to 2016. This is at 30% increase in the projected, with some confidence intervals around it. And then the red line is the uptake of deterrence adoption. And you can see the actual uptake of those preventative tools is exceeding the growth rate of wolf population. So, again, very encouraging sign. In terms of packs that have depredation activity, this in 2016, we had four packs, the Profanity Peak Pack, obviously, where the agency had initiated lethal action. We also had documented confirmed wolf depredation in the Smackout Pack and the Dirty Shirt Pack. And then early in the year, we had one in between Huckleberry and Stranger, which we think was likely the Stranger Pack, but it was the part of the pack where the two overlap. In 2016, one of those packs, as you know, reached the threshold for consideration of lethal removal. Director Unsworth approved lethal removal in the Profanity Peak Pack and removed seven wolves there to try to stop a pattern of depredations in that pack. You heard some testimony already that this protocol that we used for 2016 was designed to use for a year and then go back to the table, put everything back on the table, and kind of go through lessons learned. And right now, staff and the Wolf Advisor Group are working on the next version of a protocol, and with a recommendation to have that done by the end of the month, on the 30th of March. Not going to go into any more detail that. We've already provided you an update on that. Just to note that information, it's important that all that information gets to the public. They're very interested. And so we have, each year, we have a chronology of events so the public can see in real time as depredations occur and what's occurring. We're wanting to strengthen that this year. And also the final report for the Profanity Peak is available online as well. And so we have a pack map and information like this for every pack that we have confirmed in the state. If you look at the number of packs and the number of packs that we're depredating, we're right in that average, again, surprise, surprise, from the Northern Rocky Mountains ecosystem. About 80%, the positive, start with positive, 80% of the packs don't have conflict. The two species coexist just fine. Most of our packs overlap with livestock. 20% of the time we see conflict. And that was the percentage this year was 20%. If we zoom in a little bit and look at the number of livestock involved in those conflicts, you can see the pattern here. This last year, we had 15 depredations, confirmed depredations on livestock, and I've also plotted the number of wolves removed, and we removed 7 wolves this year. We also removed 7 wolves in 2012 in the Wedge Pack and 1 wolf in the Huckleberry in 2014. Switching gears to compensation, this one's not exactly the 2016 calendar year. This is any compensation claim that would overlap the 2016 year, so either got paid in 2016 or occurred in 2016, just claims that were within that we were processing in that 2016 window. You can see the number of claims here for injured or killed livestock and the amount paid to each. One of the things that's really important and we're trying to improve on, and we are, but we still have a ways to go, is the timely payment of those claims so that it doesn't take months and months and months.
Make a claim?
Good. That's the next slide here. They made a claim, yes, for this is a producer that had domestic sheep in the Huckleberry Pack in 2014. They had a claim for their direct losses and were paid, and had a claim for indirect losses and were paid. And so these two claims that, and I'll just want to point out and acknowledge that took a tremendous amount of time, and that's why I'm emphasizing how important it is to pay claims in a timely fashion. These two claims were completed for indirect losses, which was new for us in the 2016 calendar year. If we summarize all that in terms of the wolf population status and some of the information we've already covered, you can see again now here tabularly the same information. Here's the growth rates that we're seeing on average, about still right around that 30%. It you know, sometimes a little above, sometimes a little below. Pattern and number of mortalities, number of packs, etc. And then if we look at all the years since wolves are on the landscape, our running average is 9% in terms of the packs depredating. If you just focus on when it started, we're right at that 20% mark, so right in the neighborhood of what we've seen from other jurisdictions. Kind of on the home stretch here, real quickly on these other items. In terms of stakeholder outreach, of course, in these modern times, most of all of our information is available on the website. That's really where a lot of folks go to get the latest information, and we try to keep that information updated and in a timely manner because it is a very popular site. We also have our printed materials. We have meetings throughout the year with interested groups, with livestock producers, hunters, you know, all kinds of stakeholder groups, livestock stakeholder groups, wolf advocate groups, etc. We have a couple training opportunities every year, both for for livestock depredation trainings, but also trainings for range riders, and already mentioned the printed materials. In terms of the Wolf Advisory Group, they have been meeting now almost 2 years since the Wolf Advisory Group has been expanded to 18 members. They represent a number of stakeholders, but we kind of broadly classify kind of three main entities, if you will: livestock producers, environmentalists, or wolf advocates and hunters. They represent about 13 organizations. They met 5 times in 2016 at 3 conference calls. Some of the products, I think that's really important to note that they produce products. Some of the products they got completed were expectations for deterrence measures. They did a revision of the cost share contracts and added to that the actual expectations for each of the deterrence measures. And they also completed, as I said, the 2016 protocol for lethal removal. I'm not going to go through this list of research, but our
back to the WAG. I know there's been some people have dropped out. And I thoroughly understand that bringing new people in is a process, because they're, again, trying to get them to the same level of what everybody's at. But I've had some concerns expressed to me about getting some people back on. And are you in the process of doing that?
We are. In fact, I'm glad you asked that question. We are in the process. We put out a news release here a few weeks ago, soliciting folks that were interested. We've got applications from about 30 individuals. I put together a small team from our larger Wolf team that are together. We are dividing up and doing interviews of all those folks to create a short list, and then we'll be visiting with Director Unsworth, who will make the offers for the appointments. We have 4 vacancies right now that we're trying to fill. And I'll keep the commission updated on that process. In terms of the research, the body of research is growing each year in terms of what's happening on the landscape. We have a number of cooperative projects with WSU and UW, and I just wanted to call out one of them that we have a bigger piece of, and that's the large predator-prey project that we just started here. We did a news release to share that with the public less than a month ago. It's probably the largest effort that Washington's ever conducted of putting on literally over 100 collars on different ungulate species, multiple carnivore species, and that project's just getting underway now. Final couple slides in terms of wolf expenditures. Now, this is not the calendar year. Of course, this is the fiscal year for this last fiscal year. To give you an idea of some of the expenses, for wolf population monitoring, you can see those items, capture, monitoring, surveys, staff time, and then the contract that we have with Wildlife Services. Just a reminder that Wildlife Services cannot, due to a court action, is not able to participate in any lethal removal action. We do have a contract with them, though, to help with depredation investigations and capture and monitoring activities. And then on the conflict management side, you can see the different items there. You can also see the emphasis we have here on trying to be as preventative as possible. And then the compensation numbers are slightly different because this is for the fiscal year and not the calendar year. This final total number is very similar to what it was last fiscal year. We have a number of budget items that are a number of funding sources, though, that were either one time or they were grants from U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service. We actually, our budget is going to be going down because of those one-time sources, and the outlook is some of the grants that we get from U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service, they're slowly phasing out of that. Looking ahead, some of the things immediately on the horizon for us. Obviously, we're getting close to grazing season, so we're working with livestock producers from this point, you know, all through the summer. It's a year-round process, but prepping for a turnout. We have as you already heard, we have a WAG meeting coming up in end of the month. We're also scheduling an interagency wolf committee. That's with other government organizations and tribes and counties. And then we're continuing to focus on even more ideas and steps to try to streamline the compensation process so that is as timely as possible. With that, I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Donnie, that was great, but I was expecting a little bit more about the effort to start refocusing on the hunting-related concerns. So that's what I heard the WAG was recognizing the need to do. So do you see that happening?
Stakeholders are starting to talk about what's the next topic to talk about. And I don't know that I would characterize it as hunting. It's really once I think WAG and stakeholders complete the March assignment, it's really what does the path look like now for the next chunk of time? So it's the next 5 or 10 years, and possibly a revisiting the plan possibly as a hybrid plan, both periods of listing and delisting, or discussion about a post-delisting plan. So I'm hearing from stakeholders that they're thinking about that next, and likely starting with some visionary kinds of things, visionary concepts, and trying to come together on some common ground on vision and those kinds of things. I think that will lead to later discussions about hunting.
No, I'm sorry. I was not very clear.
Okay.
The concerns of hunters.
Okay. Thank you. That's a much easier topic, by the way.
Clear, but I'd heard that because so much of the emphasis has been about the concerns of the ag side of the world, and we have hunters on the WAG, now we're going to start turning to some of their concerns.
And they're all related. And I think it's and not one and the same, but very, very closely related, that yes, they have been engaged and been a great addition to all the dialogue with WAG and wolf livestock conflict, but they want to talk about wolf ungulate issues and concerns. And there are two things I think that are right now coming out and fresh. One is the ungulate assessment that we've just are completing, that'll be available for the public. That is just a look at each ungulate population and where it is in relation to its population objective. And if it's below, what are some of the maybe some of the factors contributing to that, and then also the larger predator prey study I just talked about. So in the setting with stakeholders in WAG, my last response is very similar to this one. It's that subject matter is the next on the docket to start talking about, is that broader spectrum of issues outside of now wolf livestock conflict.
Good. Robert. Thank you. Donnie, one of the things that really appeals to me is the migration of some of this policy, and especially some of the actual activities, to the communities which are impacted. The range riders, there's many. The communities are starting to get involved. Do you know the details of the Representative Kretz bill that just passed the House regarding community involvement? And can you tell us a little bit about that?
Yes, it's in gross substitute House Bill 2126. And what it seeks to do is create a community approach to the use and ownership of deterrent measures and resources to do that. And it forms a committee of four counties, Ponderay, Stevens, Ferry, Okanagan, where one member from each conservation district in those counties would form that committee that would then allocate and help prioritize locally owned and used resources. So fladry, resources for range riders, fencing, and down the list, that would be stored locally, available to anybody to come and pick up and use, et cetera. And that would be housed in Department of Agriculture. The department has provide testimony on that, and we're supportive of that. In fact, we encourage that what we're learning, and I think what you're seeing in those graphs there is the uptake, is that it's very important to have that local ownership, and it's community-driven rather than driven from the feel that it's driven from Olympia or from the state. And so that, in a nutshell, I think was what the bill seeks to do, and we're supportive of that. And working with Department of Agriculture to try to see if we can help get that across the finish line.
You mentioned that two of the mortalities were hunter mortalities, the Spokanes. I believe both the Spokanes and the Colvilles are permitting hunting. Is that correct? And do we know how they're regulating that, tags limited? Do we have any information about how they're managing hunting?
Yes, we work with both of the tribes, and you're correct. It was two lawful harvests on the Spokane Indian Reservation. Both tribes have a limited hunting season. The Colville tribe actually has a quota. I believe it's five or six. Please don't hold me to that, but I think it's in that neighborhood. They've never reached that. And I'm not sure about the Spokanes, whether it's a quota, but just each year I think that there's one or two harvests, so it's fairly minimal. But they both do have a hunting season.
I guess one thing I do want to say is I've been on the commission, I think I'm starting my fourth year. And the first couple years, the wolf issue is near and dear to me from not only where I live, but what I do. And honest to Pete, I could not see a good outcome. I just couldn't. I just thought it was a hopeless freaking cause that we were going to spin our wheels, end up in court, and there was just not going to be a good outcome. But I've had a 180-degree swing in this. And we were lucky to get Francine because she's gone a long ways. But that guy sitting right there is one.
I really appreciate that, Commissioner Holzmiller. Thank you very much.
Thanks. Really good presentation. Very informative. I have a question about the slide that you have regarding PACs depredating on livestock. You know, I think you referenced this year we're at 20%, and that was not surprising, I guess. I think what you said was that it was similar to the experience in the other Rocky Mountain states with wolf populations. I guess my question is do those other states have as an aggressive program of non-lethal removal, kind of, you know, the objectives, the range riding and kind of other types of things? I just want to see if that's a proper comparison. That's my question, I guess.
Good question. It's a tough one to answer. My understanding is I do think we're progressive with the use of preventative tools. I think early on, the other states spent a lot of time and a lot of resources trying to find that one thing that would prevent, and with 100% success or really high success, and they have learned and shared with us that there isn't a single or a combination of tools that just will remove the chance of conflict. And a lot of it is driven by their local society on what their, you know, how they manage that resource. So I think in Washington, we are deploying, I think, a bit more, putting more emphasis on deterrent measures. But we're also learning from the other states. I think you had a good representation, though, that it's probably not a fair comparison because there are different things at play in both of the states. It's also one where I don't want to give the impression that it's acceptable to be at 20%. If we can reduce it, we want to reduce it. You know, one of the key things we learned from other states is do all that you can to prevent the conflict. Once it starts, it's very difficult to change the behavior.
I think we're done up here.
Thank you very much.
Thanks, Donnie.
Yep, keep her up. Echoing Commissioner Holzmiller's appreciation.
Mm-hmm.
Thank you. We all share her sentiments. Thank you. We're going to take a short break now.